Dive, hark, gold, strange, under, bones, teeth, flood, gently, unfold, toes, keep, hourly, they, rats. Gold teeth gently unfold bones under rats they hourly keep. Rats hourly drive under flood toes gold bones. Gold bones keep strange rats under flood dive. Gently gold flood rats hourly. Teeth bones hark strange toes unfold gold rats. Teeth bones keep gold rats. Dive under strange flood hourly. Dive under gold flood gently. They dive toes under rats. They unfold toes under gold rats. Teeth hourly gently keep flood rats gold. Under bones dive strange teeth rats. Rats toes gently keep strange good teeth under flood bones. Hark, gold bones flood under strange dive teeth hourly. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's October 26th, 2020, and today we are hoping that the artist will speak upon 25 years of the tunnel. Yes, today for 42 Minutes, we are meeting Ted Morrissey, creator of the Tunnel at 25 website symposium and author of the recent work, The Artist Spoke, available from 12 Winters Press. The Artist Spoke is a love letter, a eulogy, and a hymn of hope. Avant-garde author Elizabeth Winters has died en route to Revelation, a literary event for her readers who have volunteered to be part of her latest and final novel without knowing that what their participation would entail. Christopher Kraft has traveled to Revelation, hoping all will be revealed and that he will be revitalized by the event. The author's death affects everything, however, especially the lives of the 753 Logos, who are devoted to Elizabeth Winters and her work. The experience of Revelation takes another turn when Chris meets Beth Winterberry, a Logos to whom he is immediately attracted. The Artist Spoke is about the love of literature, the death of reading, and the hope that books will rise again. Ted Morrissey, PhD in English Studies, is an author, teacher, lecturer, scholar, and publisher who lives near Springfield, Illinois. He is an award-winning writer, which includes his books Miss Seville, Crow Song for the Stricken, and the monograph The Beowulf Poet and His Real Monsters. More information about him and his website can be found at tedmorrissey.com, to which we'll link. It is an honor to be meeting Dr. Morrissey today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good, Doug. Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
You bet. Well, thank you for just being out there. I had no idea. It's just one of these interesting synchronicities where my book club was doing the tunnel and just poking around to get, you know, extra information. I discovered that your symposium was happening roughly about the same time, and so it was really serendipitous for us. But tell us about the Tunnel at 25, how that came to be, and, you know, your role in that project.
Well, I'm a devotee, maybe disciple isn't too strong of a word, of William H. Gass, the author, and I've been devoted to him and his writing for more than a decade now. That's mainly consisted of giving conference presentations, but also writing reviews and just trying to preach the gospel, as we say. But earlier this year, I did the math and realized that his magnum opus, The Tunnel, was turning 25 this year. And it's a really challenging book, and it doesn't really get read much anymore in spite of its winning the American Book Award and being kind of a literary icon of sorts for over 25 years as he was working on it. So I thought that I would try to, to try to get a little more interest in the book. And so I came up with this idea of having this symposium It really wouldn't be practical to have it in person. It probably wouldn't be practical to do it any time, but certainly during the pandemic, it wasn't practical. So I decided instead to create this website and to invite GAS folks to contribute material to the website and try to have some sort of online, experience for people visiting the website in terms of finding out more about the tunnel and about GAS, and hopefully encouraging them to read the tunnel.
So originally, was it going to be an in-person thing, or did it kind of happen simultaneously with the pandemic?
It happened simultaneously with the pandemic. Like I said, I didn't really do the math until this spring. It kind of popped into my head that, it's been 25 years. And so, that's one of those milestones that oftentimes we recognize books at a particular, longevity. And so, I never thought of it being some kind of a physical event. I mean, that would be wonderful, but just the logistics of planning that would be, particularly challenging.
And then part of this was in association with the library that houses his papers. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it just is a good fortune on my part, I guess. I live fairly close to St. Louis, and he was an instructor or professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and so they also archive his papers. So for the last several years, I've gotten to know the curator of those papers, a gentleman named Joel Miner, and I've visited the archives on several occasions and have used them for my own research and writing somewhat. And Joel was one of those folks I definitely wanted to be involved with contributing to the symposium, and WashU libraries, they were planning their own celebration and recognition of the tunnel as well. So we've just kind of combined forces to try to do various things somewhat in coordination together.
And so the Tunnel of 25, this website symposium, there's an introduction, and then you have different contributors writing essays about various things. One of the people, Alec Lee, I'm going to blow his last name, I think. He was the one who wrote the piece that a lot of people discover, maybe it was earlier this year, in the New York Times about the strangeness of the time the tunnel came out and how it is more in sync with our moment now. The piece that you wrote, however, for the website has to do with something that I actually found pretty difficult, which is separating William Gass from Kohler. There is some similarities between the author and the narrator in the tunnel. And if you gave like a really simple reading, you would just assume that, this is William Gass giving voice to all his dissatisfaction. Could you talk about your essay a little bit?
Yeah, the like I said, the novel came out, in kind of bits and pieces over the course of 26 years, but then ultimately it was published as a novel in 1995, and so a lot of people it'd been on their radar, for a quarter of a century, and so there was a lot of anticipation for what would the whole thing look like when it came out, and there was just a really wide variety of reactions, and there were a lot of people, a lot of reviewers who were quite actually hostile towards the novel and towards Gass himself, because the main character of the novel is very much like Gass in a number of ways. For one thing, his name is William Kohler versus William Gass. He's a professor at a university, as Gass was throughout his career, and in fact, the university seems very much like Purdue University, which is where Gass was teaching when he started writing the tunnel in 1966. And so there's just a lot of similarities between the main character and the author himself. And so consequently, as you say, a lot of reviewers found a lot of the things that Kohler, the narrator, has to say, which are quite harsh oftentimes. Some people have viewed him as sort of a Nazi sympathizer, although that's kind of a whole other issue to get into. But nevertheless, they had a really hard time separating Kohler, the narrator, from Gass, the author. And so there was a lot of hostility kind of directed at the book and at Gass. He claimed that he was intentionally kind of blurring those lines in part to sort of test readers to see which readers were, you know, adept at being able to separate an author from their work, or and those that were more inclined to sort of fall into that trap of thinking that the narrators of books were essentially the voices of their authors. And so he claimed that he was anticipating that potential, you know, reaction, and that it was a test he was giving reviewers, and a lot of them failed, he said. So,
well, initially, so this is what's tricky. I think my first time through it, I definitely was failing, because it is such an unfiltered dark lens through which you're viewing this. And so it was hard for me not to look at Gass's bio and think that so much of that must be him. But then, you know, after I spoke about it in our actual club, and then I went back through the book again 3/4 of the way or so. I didn't go all the way, but pretty close. And at that point in time, it definitely seemed like he was doing something really interesting, because we generally, you know, and this is the idea that everyone's thoughts are personal and private, and so to really be, you know, I wouldn't want my thoughts out in the world, you know, it's really an interesting view into this man's consciousness. How many times have you read The Tunnel?
Well, I've read it through and through twice, but I've dipped into it and read sections of it, wrote about sections of it on multiple occasions. This past summer, I intended to reread it stem to stern again, and then it got away from me, time did. And so I didn't read it completely again this past summer, but I did, again, read a lot of sections of it. Plus, I was, you know, sort of editing a lot of the contributions to the symposium, and part of that was to go back and check people's quotes and make sure they were accurate and things like that. And then doing this during the pandemic was kind of an interesting experience in and of itself. There was one contributor who really wanted to contribute, but he had gotten separated from his copy of The Tunnel. And so he couldn't find, you know, he didn't have any access to the quotes that he wanted to use in his paper. And so I happily volunteered to be his research assistant. So he kind of gave me kind of some general ideas, what sorts of quotes he was looking for. So I pored through it and found some quotes and so forth, and sent those to him via email. And so he used those to finalize his paper. So I haven't read it, you know, in its entirety for a while, but like I said, I keep dipping into it over the years. I listened to your, podcasts about The Tunnel, and I was duly impressed. You know, I was kept thinking, gosh, I hope he doesn't quiz me during the podcast, because he seems to know it better than I do at this point. But you all really got into some very you know, fine details about the book, and had a really interesting discussion about it.
Well, thank you. So I actually listen to a lot of books these days, because it's easier for me. I have plenty of dumb time to listen to things. I'm wondering, have you ever been exposed to the, you know, William Gass reading his own book? It's quite fabulous.
Yeah, the audiobook, that it is something else. He was a great reader of his own work, I always felt. And yeah, the audiobook is like 45 hours of listening enjoyment. But, you know, so it's quite an investment to listen to the whole thing. But he is a great reader of his work. And, you know, luckily, besides that, we have, you know, YouTube videos of him reading his work. And I got to see him live on 3 occasions reading his work. So that was a great experience as well. But yeah, he does a great job in that audiobook. I know there were a lot of outtakes. That's one of the things that the Gass Archive has at Washington University, is the outtakes of his audio reading. I have not listened to those, but I hear there are some, you know, they kind of get a little bit giddy at times, you know, as you can imagine when you're reading that much material, you can kind of probably get a little bit flustered at times, but.
Well, the experience I had with the audiobook is what So when I read your essay that you presented at a conference about the architecture of the tunnel, or the tunnel as architecture, the audiobook really, I had that same experience where it seems like there's, you don't have a ton of context when you start this book, and it kind of begins to accumulate. But I realized that there's enough context that it's almost like a record where you could drop the needle anywhere and eventually you'd be up to speed. You know, like you were talking about each of the Philippics as its own separate kind of room. And from one room, you could view another room. You know, you would get more information, but you would see things from different perspectives, which was really interesting. But I really appreciated that essay because you articulated something that I was grokking, like, you know, the audiobook, you could really put the audio on shuffle and, you know, you would have a different experience every time, but it would be, I don't feel like you would be necessarily losing anything if you weren't going in the order that he had set out in the published book.
Right, right. No, I think you're definitely right. And I know you talked in your other podcast about the fact that he, in his perfect world, the tunnel would have been released as just a loose sheaf of papers, you know, unbound. And so that really would have encouraged readers to sort of pour through it at their discretion. You know, and it would have been stuffed with like old paper bags and crossword puzzles and all kinds of things, you know, in between the pages of the manuscript. And so that too would have, you know, encouraged people to jump in here versus there and not necessarily read it from page one to page, you know, 652 or whatever it would be, you know, straight through or whatever. Yeah, that whole idea of his, well, you know, one of the things I find so fascinating about Gass's work is he was very interested in other art forms and tried to sort of use those as inspiration for his writing. So architecture was certainly one of those art forms that he was very interested in and used it as sort of a model for a lot of his work, but also music, you know, and other sorts of things. And so, his trying to kind of marry some of the techniques and some of the elements of other art forms into his writing, I always found very admirable and very interesting.
Well, now I'm curious, are you familiar at all with Mark Z. Danielewski's House of Leaves?
I am not. I mean, I am by reputation, and it's, you know, one of a thousand books is on my list that I know I should read, but I have not actually read it. But I, in your podcast, I know you discussed it quite a bit, especially comparing it to Gass's The Tunnel. And I certainly, you know, it made sense to me, a lot of what you were saying regarding how the two books operate, et cetera.
Well, it's hard for me not to believe that he was really heavily using the tunnel as inspiration. So House of Leaves came out in 2000, you know, he kind of conceived the idea in like about 94, I think, but there's just so much playfulness with the text and like the artistry of the visual layout of the pages that I can't not believe that he wasn't inspired by The Tunnel, which I really feel like in that respect was just light years ahead of anything else. I mean, I know there are other books like that, but just the level of detail that you would have to have with the typesetter really is amazing to me.
Right. Well, are you familiar with Gass's Willie Masters' Lonesome Wife, that little novella that came out in 1968?
This was my introduction to Gass, and like we said in the podcast, for whatever reason, there's such strange coincidence or confusion between Gaddis and Gass, and it's probably just the last name.
Right. Well, partly the last name, but also, I mean, obviously, you know, the Williams, but you know, they sort of ran in similar circles and were often, you know, kind of spoken of in the same breath. They were friends and they went to Russia together to do a literary sort of diplomatic mission, I think, and give some readings and so forth. And so they had a very interesting relationship themselves. And And actually, I think in your podcast, you mentioned Gaddis's big book, The Recognitions. And my actual first reading of Gass was his introduction to The Recognitions. And one of the things he talks about in that is he sort of jokes about the fact that people have always confused their biographies and kind of mixed up details into sort of a hybrid, you know, hybrid single author with kind of bits and pieces of their various biographies kind of mixed into it or whatever. But yeah, they definitely, you know, were oftentimes kind of confused with one another.
But back to this idea of Mark Danielewski, it's interesting because the type of fans that he has and the, you know, what he's done in recent years reminds me of your character, Elizabeth Winters. The idea of his fans all getting tattoos of a single word seems like something that those people are already doing. And so do you want to talk a little bit about The Artist Spoke?
Sure. I appreciate that opportunity. Yeah, it's this novel of mine that's just sort of coming out into the world now. You know, actually, my inspiration initially was the author Shelley Jackson. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she actually did a project called Skin a number of years ago, which was basically her story imprinted one word at a time on people's skin. And, you know, and the only way to know the book, to read the book, was to be part of it. And then presumably you would send her a picture of your tattoo and she would send the participants, you know, all the other tattoos in order so you could read it. And I'm not really a tattoo guy. I don't have anything against it. I think I just have commitment issues, so I've never been able to actually get a tattoo. But if I were going to get one, that would be something I would have been interested in. But I was a Johnny come lately to that project, and she had all the skin she needed for her book. But that always had kind of lodged into my brain, and I tried to write about that, tried to write a novel or a short story about it several times over the years. And finally, and I can't remember if it was late 2015 or very early 2016, I kind of found a way into the book. And in my version of things, there's an author, which, again, I've kind of modeled after Shelley Jackson, but I call her Elizabeth Winters, and she has gotten 753 people to volunteer to be a part of this book and get a tattoo. But they don't really know beyond that what it all entails, and there's going to be this big literary event called Revelation, where she's going to be there and explain to them exactly what their participation in the project is going to be, et cetera. But lo and behold, she dies in a plane accident. I'm not giving much away. This happens on the first page of the novel. So with her goes her plan. She had not shared with anyone exactly what she had in mind with her book. And so you have all these people with these tattoos who are connected and that they're part of the book, but they don't know what the story is about or what their sort of part of it is, what part they play in it and that kind of thing. And so then that kind of, you know, that's sort of the catalyst for the plot of the book from there on out.
Yeah. And so the piece that I wrote, read at the very beginning was some of the words from this prologue to this story. But, you know, what you muse on in this novel is, you know, the idea of publishing and poetry, but also, you know, perspective and meaning. I'm curious about the length of this work and what that has to do with both, you know, publishing and where we're at now with how people read.
The length of my book, you mean?
Yeah,
or...
yeah, this work.
Oh, okay.
You know, was that influenced at all by how people read these days, or?
In terms of its brevity, you're saying? Or...
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, no, it is a shorter, more diminutive sort of novel. You know, that word novel is an interesting one. I actually teach in Lindenwood University's MFA program. And I teach a course in the long story and the novella. And one of the issues we deal with is, you know, what's the difference? When does a long story become a novella? When does a novella become a novel? You know, are there some actual, you know, artistic guidelines, or is it just a matter of semantics and so forth? So I know there certainly are people out there that would consider my novel more of a novella in terms of length. I think it comes out of 188 pages or something like that. But you know, I'm of the opinion that you know, a novel is what we make of it. I mean, it is sort of a matter of semantics. You know, to kind of bring it back to Gass here. I mean, that's kind of one of the lessons I think I learned from Gass, in that you know, you look at something like The Tunnel, and you certainly could probably make a case that it's more of a, I don't know, collection of short stories or a collection of long stories, maybe a collection of novellas, but yet they all kind of tie together in a way that that they have this sort of, you know, this novelistic feel to them. And so I've really broadened my own sense of what a novel is in terms of, you know, not being too concerned about length and that kind of thing, but rather, you know, is it sort of an artistic whole? Does it make it a whole artistic statement as a book? And if so, then, you know, it kind of qualifies as a novel. So anyway, yeah, it takes me a long time to write a book, for one thing. You know, I'm a teacher, and I don't really have as much time to write as I would like. And so I basically have about 30 or 40 minutes a day that I can really devote to my writing. So at that clip, it can take quite a while to amass a whole manuscript. And so, you know, I think part of it is, you know, after a number of years of working on a project, I'm sort of ready to put a bow on it and put it out into the world. And so I probably do tend to think in terms of a little bit shorter units than what maybe the traditional novelist might. But there certainly is that phenomenon that our reading attention span, you know, those of us who still do read, has kind of gotten shorter and shorter over the years. I write a lot of short stories, or although they tend to be more kind of episodes and larger works that I'm working on, but I like to send them out and get them published kind of along the way. And increasingly over the years, the length of, you know, quote unquote short stories that little magazines, you know, literary magazines will even consider, is just getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Pretty much nowadays, if you have something beyond 5,000 words, it's just increasingly difficult to even find some place to send it. You know, everyone now wants flash fiction, or, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 words is kind of their absolute max. And so I think, you know, there definitely is that phenomenon in our culture that people do not want, you know, longish books, certainly. And of course, that also contributes to why people tend not to want to read The Tunnel. It's a huge book to try to get into, and most people just don't have the patience or the gumption to even kind of wade into something like that.
Well, yeah. And for my money, I don't know that, like, things are what they are, and they either, you know, work or they don't. And so there's a lot of stuff that happens, you know, even though this is a, like you were saying, like the brevity of the work, there's a lot going on in there. And so one of the things that I was interested in is, well, I love that there's just these hints of sci-fi on the edges every now and again. It's just a hint that there's more going on than, you know, what meets the eye. But I really like this theme of, you know, considering different perspectives. So, you know, you in the writing class, there's the peeper exercise, which I thought was fun. But then also when Chris is at the art exhibit, you know, he says, I'm going to go through this differently than, you know, which reminded me of your essay in The Tunnel too, where, you know, I'm sure this is curated a certain way, but I want to see it from a different perspective, you know, and all of that kind of illuminates, right, my own feeling about how literature gives you a view into someone else's head. You get to live a different life, which I don't really feel like TV does, because you participate in a book, whereas TV just kind of passes over you.
Right, right. Yeah, the art museum scene, I that was one of the, you know, I enjoyed that, writing that one in particular. I had actually, at a conference a couple of years ago, I went to a presentation, and, you know, you go to these literature conferences, and most of the presentations, of course, are about people talking about books. But this particular woman, her specialty was reading museums. And she basically would go to various museums, with the idea being that whoever put the museum together, you know, chose the exhibits and the order in which they go, and the plaques that go along with them to explain what the exhibits are, et cetera, that they've got a particular, you know, narrative in mind that they're trying to express to visitors to the museum. And so her specialty was to sort of read that and see, well, what does this museum seem to be saying about, you know, whatever its subject is. And so that, I was kind of mindful of that as I wrote that scene. It's Chris who goes through it as it's sort of laid out, but it's the other character, the other main character, Beth Winterberry, who's the rebel, and she's the one who doesn't want to be manipulated by the museum and goes through it in a different order, just to kind of try to get her own perspective on things. In my books, the women are always smarter than the guys, because I think that's kind of the way real life is. So
your book also starts on a train, which it might not, you know, have any more meaning than that was the best transportation for Chris to take to get to the conference. But there's something about just starting there that I felt like removed it from, you know, so he wasn't able to have his devices. It seemed like he was out of bounds of the normal reality space at the beginning of this, which set a nice tone for the whole thing, I think, because there is... I did get there's this feeling of, like, if you ever have gone to a conference or something where you're completely out of your normal life, and, you know, it's almost like more of a dream space in some regards. And I felt like you really captured that well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, a lot of what I was playing with in this book is this idea of only having kind of partial knowledge of things. You know, we keep encounter, or in the book, you know, they keep encountering things where they sort of have a hint or maybe a few details about this. And so they're always trying to sort of construct, you know, what the whole is based on these hints and these little bits of details. And you know, generally speaking, I don't really, you know, comment on how successful they are, because quite frankly, oftentimes I don't know how successful they are in terms of what they're kind of reconstructing. But I do feel like, you know, we live in this kind of weird time where, on the one hand, we are drowning in an ocean of information, whether it's tweets or, you know, alerts on our phones or whatever it is. But yet at the same time, you know, so much of it is fragmentary, and we get all these sort of distorted views of things in spite of all the information. In fact, you know, I'm of an age, I mean, I'm 58, where I you know, I grew up without all of that stuff. And in retrospect, maybe I'm just being nostalgic or something, but I really felt like, in many ways, when I was younger, I had sort of a better grasp of the world around me. Probably I just, you know, it was just simpler or something, but nowadays, in spite of all of our technology, and like I said, this constant flood of information, it seems to make everything, you know, more slippery and harder to understand and so on.
Well, I also have to comment on the tension that propels this book, because of how you set up your author, you really don't know what's going on. I mean, you know what's happening, but like you said, you only have fragments, and so you can only speculate, you know, if there is more than meets the eye, especially since the larger work is what is it called, something conspiracy,
the isolation of conspiracy, yeah,
right. But the interesting thought I had is that her bibliography is very complete, and our protagonists are constantly talking about, you know, their favorite parts of this different literary background. Do you have any desire to, you know, go through and explore some of these works that Elizabeth Winters has written?
I do. You know, it's funny because when I, on the first drafting of this, I was just sort of throwing, you know, titles out there and didn't really have much idea what they were about or whatever. And when I kind of finished a complete draft, which was this past spring, and then I've been working for the last several months on revising. And for me, revision is almost always adding to. And a lot of what that adding to was fleshing out her bibliography and so on. For example, I made some sort of enigmatic reference to some reading she did in Sedona, Arizona that was sort of infamous, but that's all I said about it at the time because I didn't know. I just kind of threw it out there. And then as I was revising, I thought, I wonder what that was all about. I wonder what was going on with that. So then I had to kind of figure out, well, what happened in that reading that was so mysterious and how does that kind of, you know, complement or you know, contradict or confuse, you know, other things in the book or whatever. So yeah, that was one of the fun parts too, is coming up with these titles of books and stories and so forth that don't actually exist, and then kind of referencing characters in them and so on. So they're kind of were being, you know, kind of being created through the process of creating my own book. You know,
poetry is also important to the characters in this book, and it definitely was important to William Gass as well. Just thinking about the character, it created a world that I wanted to be in, as far as like a celebrated author. Now, of course, we aren't sure whether or not it's legitimate. So Chris's ex, Katie, isn't sure whether or not she's just a good marketer. But I was thinking back, I think, you know, in the 60s, people read poetry. There were people who would publish collections that everyday folks would buy.
Right. Well, it's definitely something that's a part of my you know, thoughts. You know, I grew up in a time where literature was important and people read books and talked about books and you know, and I kind of set my sights on being a writer under the understanding or the expectation that at least some people would read what I was writing and maybe talk about it a little bit. And lo and behold, I finally get to a point in my life where maybe I have enough skill set that I can actually write some decent stuff. And I've kind of run into the experience where there's nobody who really wants to read it. You know, it's like, I'm really nostalgic for those days where, you know, writing was important and people would go to poetry readings and all kinds of things. And, you know, we just, I think if you live in a big enough city, you can still find maybe that kind of niche population. But if you're kind of living amongst the cornfields, you know, as I am, it's really hard to find that kind of community that really supports that. You know, I'm interested in all literature, but the modernists and James Joyce and Gertrude Stein and that sort of thing. And I'm fascinated by the fact that those writers, you know, that I just mentioned, plus others like Virginia Woolf, et cetera, you know, were writing these really difficult, challenging books, but yet the general population, you know, knew who they were and kind of knew what was going on about their work. And not that necessarily everybody was, you know, reading every word of Finnegan's Wake as it was published, you know, episodically or something. But I mean, people knew who James Joyce was and they knew about his work. And, you know, the New York Times would review literary journals, you know, and write about the new releases, you know, of these avant-garde journals and what was in them and who was in them. And, you know, when Gertrude Stein returned to the U.S. after all those years of being in Paris, she received a hero's welcome. I mean, they ran her name on lights in Times Square, you know, and we just don't live in a world now where there's that much interest people who take writing really seriously, whether it's novels or poetry or whatever it is. And I really miss those days. I wish it were that kind of world now. And so I think that nostalgia probably crept into my book quite a bit.
Speaking of reading and writing, so what are you reading these days? What do you like to read? And then, what are you working on for the future?
Well, I'm a very wide-ranging sort of reader. I've got a lot of different things going on. One of the things I'm about, because of this, the Tunnel at 25 project, I kind of got to know some other folks out there who were interested in similar kinds of writing, similar kinds of authors. So I got an invitation to write something about Robert Coover for a kind of an anthology that's being put together in celebration of his 89th birthday next year. And I'm not really, too much of a Coover person. I don't have anything against Robert Coover. I just haven't read a lot of his work. So anyway, I decided I wanted to work with his novel Noir, which is a kind of detective, kind of a weird postmodern detective novel. And so I've been reading that with a mind of, I'm going to be writing about it. So I'm kind of reading it in a little bit different way than you might read other kinds of things. Normally I would be, really thinking hard about another kind of gas paper. But right now I don't have anything specific on the horizon. So, I'm not really doing that sort of thing, but actually when you called, I was reading The Turn of the Screw. I'm teaching that to my high school students right now, cause that's another gig. That's my main gig, in fact. So I'm reading a little Henry James on the side too, while we're going through lots of other things. In terms of my own writing, I've been working on a new, I'll call it a novel, set in the early part of the 20th century. It's all set during about a 24-hour period where a big blizzard has hit this little community, and everyone's kind of got their own sort of little stories, but they're all interconnected and so on. Three of the pieces, the first three pieces, in fact, they were published here and there, but I sent them to Word Runner, which is a little press that does e-books, and they selected it to do a kind of an e-chat book. So the first three stories are going to come out in a little miniature collection in December. But in the meantime, I've added a fourth episode, and I've just started working on a fifth episode. So that's kind of what I'm focusing on creative writing now. So a lot of different things happening.
Well, that was 42 minutes. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you, Doug. I really appreciate it.
You bet. You've been listening to Ted Morrissey on 42 Minutes, a production of Syncbook. Great to check out past shows. Be sure and visit, for more information about Dr. Morrissey, visit his website, tedmorrissey.com. For more information about the Syncbook, our guest, check out past shows, subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Please be sure and visit our website at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, check out others. It's currently all the Syncbook Radio archives are free. We also feature a great search engine to help you find what you need. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com. Thanks so much. And I have to end with this quote by William Gask, because it's so enigmatic, but he said, "I write because I hate a lot. Hard."
Absolutely.